I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point.
There are often times what we learn in our history books only scratch the surface of what really happened. When we think of the American Revolution, what names come to mind? Sam Adams? Paul Revere? John Hancock? John Adams? What about Joseph Warren? Who, you say? According to our guest today, Dr. Joseph Warren is one of the unsung heroes of the American Revolution. Historian and New York Times bestselling author Nathaniel Philbrook has a new book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. He joins me in our Boston studio at WGBH. Welcome.
Hi, Mindy. Great to be here.
Nice to see you again. So the book begins with John Quincy Adams, who was seven at the time, with his mom, Abigail, standing on a hillside at their home in Braintree, watching the Battle of Bunker Hill. That for them was the decisive moment that the American Revolution started.
Yeah, actually, Abigail called it the decisive day. And it's interesting because John Quincy's father, John Adams, was 300 miles away in Philadelphia and chose to see the beginning of the revolution as something that was ideological, that was in the hearts and minds of the people. But clearly for his son, who was traumatized by what he saw and would remember it all his life, it was this battle where the reality of what the ideology had led them to was there. And it was, you know, it was scary more than anything else.
And you could just imagine the impact on a seven-year-old boy. As a matter of fact, he refused to attend any of the anniversaries of the battle as an adult.
Exactly. John Quincy Adams was so moved by the loss of Joseph Warren. Joseph Warren had been their personal physician and had actually repaired his fractured finger in his right hand. And he later said in life that if that hadn't been properly repaired, he might not have been able to write the way he had. Yeah, and writing was everything to him. So it was a loss he would always feel.
Right. We're going to get to Joseph Warren. But first, let's set the scene for Boston at the time, a city of 15,000 on a land connected island, about a square acre when you think about that. One square mile. Square mile. Okay. I was going to say, yeah, square mile. And it's occupied by British troops. So talk about what the city was like at that time.
Yeah, it was really an island, surrounded by islands. If you fly into Boston Harbor, you can see them. And it was dominated by three hills so that the houses were all packed in what was called the North End, which we still have, and the South End. And this suddenly, this little town of 15,000 was occupied by hundreds and then thousands of British troops when several months after the Boston Tea Party, the Parliament instituted the Boston Port Act, which basically shut down the commercial port of Boston. And so suddenly this town was occupied by soldiers. And inevitably, with soldiers in their midst, tensions would rise. And I track the first half of the book is really about those growing tensions.
Growing tensions, right. And it must have been interesting for you as you kind of go back and visit some of these historically significant spots and try to, visualize that because the topography has changed so much. It isn't the same city. So trying to get your head into that.
Right. It really messes with your head because, you know, when you drive into Boston now, it's urban sprawl. Skyscrapers, all where there used to be water. The Back Bay was the Back Bay. It was water.
Right.
And there are still hints of the old town. If you walk, I have an apartment actually in the South End, and if you walk Washington Street in, you are on what was the Neck. And it was this little neck of land, only 100 yards wide in some parts, that led from Roxbury to Boston. And then if you follow Washington Street today, there is the Old South Meeting House, which is still there. You go on a little farther, there is the Old State House, which was then known as the Town House. There are some churches, other churches and buildings such as that. But you really have to it's an act of imagination,
right,
as much as anything, and maps were essential to my research process.
Exactly. And just in visualizing, you live on Nantucket, about 15,000 people.
Yeah.
And everybody may not know everybody else, but you certainly recognize most people. And that's what Boston would have been like at this time.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you live in a town of about that, you recognize pretty much everyone. And it's interesting, there's accounts of people who lived in Philadelphia at this time, which is larger, saying that I basically know everyone in the city. It was very personal. It wasn't necessarily ideology as much as who you knew, who you liked, who you disliked, and sometimes you weren't quite sure why you ended up on one side of the issue. It's just where you did it, much the way it is today.
What's fascinating to me is that some of the players that we know very little about, but were really key figures in history, most notable being Joseph Warren. Had he lived, he would no doubt be a name we would all recognize.
Yeah, I know. He died tragically at Bunker Hill, but he was the one who gave Paul Revere the orders to alert the countryside that the British were headed to Concord. He was the one who then became president of the provincial Congress, so he was running the government, which was then the congressional body of whatever Massachusetts was after Lexington and Concord. So he was madly helping put together an army, trying to raise money. And then he was named a major general going into the Battle of Bunker Hill. And so this was a guy who had natural charisma, who enjoyed a crisis, one of those people who was wired for a revolution, that when things got more upsetting, he rose to the fore. And there was a loyalist who said that this was as much a snipe at Washington as it was anything else, but the loyalist said, had Warren survived the Battle of Bunker Hill, Washington would have been an obscurity.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Washington in a little bit because it was some eye-opening things there about him for me, too. Important to note that the British and the colonists fought on the same side in the French and Indian Wars, and this becomes an important point as the tension mounts.
Yes. Well, you know, we tend to think of the Revolution as sort of this spontaneous eruption that exists in almost a historical bubble, but it had ancient history, and it was something in my earlier book, Mayflower. One of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was I began to realize that what happened in the 17th century was influenced by the previous century. And throughout the French and Indian Wars, Massachusetts soldiers and British regulars had fought side by side. They were brothers in arms. Not that they were liked each other all the time. But what you see is once the war in Canada, what we call Canada, was won, and the Americans grow disaffected with how they're being treated by the empire, they transfer all of the rage that had been directed towards the French and Indians towards their former brothers in arms, the regulars, they knew how to fight. They had been trained how to fight. Each town had its own militia that dated back more than 100 years. And so New England was uniquely situated to put up, have some force behind the rhetoric.
To take on these military people, yeah. And also interesting to know, and I hadn't really thought about this, but it isn't so much King George that they're having. They still look at him as their leader, but it's the parliamentary legislation that they're really upset with. So we have British troops stationed in Boston in 1768 to protect the crown-appointed colonial officials.
Yes.
And this is where we start to see that anger building.
Right. And it was called the Massachusetts Government Act, which came after the Port Act. And this really infuriated the Massachusetts people, where former officials that they had elected were now being appointed from Britain. And it was a kind of a tortured logic, because they felt that their English liberties were being violated, but they also pledged allegiance to their king.
Right.
Because they referred to the British soldiers as ministerial troops, it was Parliament. And, you know, the reality was that the king did not, thought this was the right thing to clamp down. But the colonists, it gives you an understanding of how strongly tied they were to England before this. No one was thinking of independence. They didn't. That was unimaginable. And yet, if you pushed this as far as you could, that would be the natural result. But they were very resistant to that. Hence, this kind of unreal allegiance to the king. And eventually the king said, look, do not claim loyalty to me. Right. You are rebels.
So we have the situation. 1770, we have the Boston Massacre, where 5 civilians are killed by British troops in a very tense situation. This is where we really start to see those tensions escalating, right?
Yeah. But what's interesting, that they flared up there, then they began to die down quickly. But then that's when Samuel Adams, who you might say if there was a mastermind behind mm-hmm. anything, came up with the idea of the Committee of Correspondence, by which he began this committee, 21 members in Boston, began to send out letters to each town. There were 250 towns throughout Massachusetts saying, look, parliamentary laws are not as important as natural laws. And these are kind of tutorials. And then they began to get these responses from the country towns. And then what they had done is turned the town meeting that usually dealt with issues like building bridges mm-hmm. and roads into forums about talking the issues of the days, you know, kind of chat rooms. Right. And so the feedback they were getting was, yes, we're with you, Boston. And what they were saying is, we fought for our – they weren't interpreting it as, you know, Parliament versus Congress, all that kind of thing. For them, it was defending the rights, the life of – way of life that they had – their forefathers had died for. And they made it clear that they were willing to fight. And so Sam Adams, through this correspondence, really used it as a communications network that united his cause.
Mm. We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Bunker Hill. So it was 3 years after the Boston Massacre that we have that Boston learns about this tea tax.
Yes, and the famous Boston Tea Party. And this is really the beginning of it all, because the groundwork had been laid. Everyone sort of knew the issues going on. And, you know, it was actually a windfall for the consumer. Britain was cutting the price of their tea by a third. But they included a very tiny tax. And this was not a good idea in retrospect, because it gave the Patriots ideological grounds to reject the tea. And so what happened was, three ships came to Boston with loads of tea that were to be offloaded to designated tea consignees who were loyalists, who were then given the right to sell it. And the Patriots said, no, you cannot offload this tea. Send it back. And Governor Hutchinson refused to allow it, and hence the Tea Party. The tea, instead of being offloaded, was thrown into Boston Harbor. And this changed everything. When word got back to Parliament and the King, they said, this is outrageous. They have to pay for the tea. They have to suffer for what they have done. And they instituted the Port Act, which shut down the town. And Bostonians were outraged, because only a handful of people had took part in that. But without any kind of trial, the entire city had been condemned. Their English liberties had been violated. Yeah. And then they had a royal governor was instituted, who also happened to be a general, poor, beleaguered Governor Thomas Gage. Yeah. And he was given the impossible task of implementing these acts.
Yeah, before we get to Thomas Gage, let's go back to Governor Hutchinson for a second. He wasn't a very well-liked man.
No, he was despised, and he got an unfair rap. I mean, he had deep sympathy for many of the issues that the Patriots were rallying around, but he felt that it was his job not to question, not to rebel, but to try to work it out. And that was not what Sam Adams and the Patriots wanted. And so they vilified Hutchinson. They even stole, with the help of Benjamin Franklin in London, stole some of his private correspondence that was then leaked to the papers. This created outrage in Boston and led to Hutchinson's downfall.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about what we, you know, you hear this tar and feathering and you don't really think about what it is. But you've got a scene in the book. We've got this John Malcolm. He's a 50-year-old customs agent, not a likable fellow at all. But he's tarred and feathered not once, but twice. You know, I guess once in Maine and once in Boston. I mean, that's how unlikable he is. But boy, this is a really brutal experience.
Yeah, I think, you know, it wasn't the French Revolution in terms of that kind of death toll, but it was violent in its own way. And tar and feathering is not a happy process.
No.
It's, you know, this was the coldest day of the winter in January 1774. Malcolm, who did create his own problems, a violent crowd, surrounded his house, dragged him from the house, took him up to the what's now the old State House near where the massacre had occurred, stripped his clothes, poured hot tar onto his flesh, which would have effectively parboiled it, and then threw feathers on it, and then kept him out all night, marching him through the streets of Boston, whipping him on an occasion, and eventually just rolling him out of a cart at his house. And he would be in bed for 6 weeks recovering. His flesh would flake off his back in what were described as stakes, but he would survive. Mm-hmm. And and yet his younger brother, who by that time had died, had been one of the leading patriots. It just shows you that this was a crisis that divided families.
Right. And again, you had to choose one side or the other. And
it was a civil war in many ways.
Yeah, it was. So we have the arrival of Thomas Gage. And you say he arrives as this Port Act is being put into effect, shutting down Boston Harbor. But he seems a likable guy.
Yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for Thomas Gage. He like everyone in Britain, underestimated what was going on. He did not understand that, wait a minute, these towns all have militias. These are, in many cases, experienced warriors. There is some might behind the rhetoric. And he thought with four regiments of soldiers, he could contain Boston. And he could. The problem was everywhere else.
Right.
And as he occupied Boston in the summer of 1774, the countryside was going nuts. People were rioting, expelling king-appointed appointees who were then forced to flee into Boston, which eventually became a city under siege. And Gage might have had a shot if he just had the Port Act to institute, which shut down the Boston commercially. It was when Parliament decided to strip Massachusetts of its government that his task was rendered impossible.
Right. Now, one of the things that the Patriots did, they decided we want to ban anything imported from Britain, and not just in Boston. They wanted all 13 colonies to take part in this. And this was important that everybody be on the same page.
Yeah. Well, it was absolutely essential, because what happened was Boston became a rallying point for all of the colonies. And these colonies were not all on the same page to begin with. Each one was very different, was very jealous of its own rights. And they were not accustomed to thinking together. But with Boston providing this example, people rallied behind it. Charleston, South Carolina, they sent up bags of rice. Other provisions came from just about every city in the colonies. And so suddenly, the colonies were thinking, if not as one, something approaching that. And so this was a metamorphosis that was not just happening in Boston and Massachusetts, but up and down the seaboard.
Let's talk about the militia that, you know, we have Joseph Warren, who, as you mentioned, very charismatic, and he had this gift of pulling people together. So talking to militia members, you know, some who may want to go home, and I think at one point there was some group in Connecticut, okay, we served this long and now we're going home.
Yeah.
But he was able to, really get in there and talk the talk, not just as a cheerleader, but really kind of emphasizing the importance of what was at stake.
Yeah. Well, he was one of these leaders who there was true ideology behind what he was doing. He really, truly believed in what he did. Unlike Sam Adams, he had a real sympathy for the people. I mean, he understood them, wanted to understand them. And one of the early problems they had after Lexington and Concord was this army was created of thousands of militiamen who had most of them had no previous history in anything like this. And they were not used to taking orders. Mm-hmm. They came from town meetings where everyone had a voice, where everything was done by consensus. So when an officer would tell them, hey, we're going to do this, they'd say, no, wait, we're going to vote on it. And this is not like military.
Right.
And so Warren was the one who began to talk with them. He was the one holding this army that was always threatening to fall apart. He was holding it together.
And I thought this was interesting. There's a bit of what, you know, we might call in sports the trash talk.
Yeah.
And so this is after the powder alarm. I'm quoting from your book. John Andrews told of the huge farmer who marched proudly into Boston between the ranks of soldiers lining the neck, looking very sly and contemptuously on one side and the other, which attracted the notice of the whole regiment, The giant farmer stopped and addressed the regulars around him. "Aye, aye," he crowed, "you don't know what boys we got in the country. I'm near 9 feet high and one of the smallest among them."
Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes in the book because, you know, what happens is Boston becomes the city under British occupation and under siege. And yet it's quite porous early on before Lexington and Concord. Country people are strutting into Boston, doing this kind of thing, and they're actually leaving Boston with weapons and arms. And Gage does not have martial law, so he is basically powerless. They're running rings around him, and it's infuriating. Here he's, you know, they've got him bottled up, but he's unable to control what's going on as the country people are arming themselves with munitions and even cannons from Boston that they're getting out. And so he's watching his world turn upside down. And it's the people from the country that prove to be the true radicals in Massachusetts.
And I think the British were pretty surprised when it came to the actual fighting.
Yeah.
These guys were pretty good fighters.
Well, you know, some of their experience in the French and Indian War, officers like to denigrate the militiamen as saying, you know, they're good for digging fortifications, but when it comes to fighting, they run, that kind of thing. And there may have been some basis to that, but the fact of the matter is there was an entirely different motivation when it came to Lexington and Concord. These people saw themselves as defending their homes, their way of life. Mm-hmm. And so all of the anger that they had funneled towards the French and Indians was now turned on the regulars, and they were very willing to fight. And so what happened on April 19th, 1775, completely startled most of the British officers. They did not expect that these militiamen would have the audacity to fire upon them, let alone put up the tremendous fight that they did. And so what happened were the British get to Concord and then have to get back. Mm-hmm. And so what's known as the Battle Road, turning the roads that still exist, linking Concord to Lexington, to Cambridge, to Charleston, Charlestown, became this road of death where militiamen gathered around the soldiers as they were retreating and fired upon them, and dozens of people would die. There's a house in what's now Arlington where 12 militiamen would be killed when British forces came in and fired upon them. And, you know, this was scary. This is the kind of thing that John Quincy Adams, as a 7-year-old, was terrified of.
Right.
And it changed people in New England. As a minister said, my flock was mild. Now they are hardened with anger. And poor General Gage in Boston. What do I do now?
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little about the relationship between Joseph Warren and his brother John.
Yeah. Well, they were an extraordinary family. Their father had died when Joseph was 14, just starting Harvard, and when his younger brother John was just 2. And in fact, he fell from an apple tree in the family orchard, and the father died. It was John's first memory. And Joseph Warren was one of the foremost doctors in Boston, and his younger brother was his apprentice. And by the time the revolution erupted, was a newly minted doctor in Salem. But it had been Joseph Warren who at 14 had taken over the responsibilities of being the parent of the family. And they were very close. But Joseph Warren was kind of this charismatic, if it needs to be done, I can do it. John was more conservative, particularly when it came to issues of money and things like that. So Joseph Warren is trying to fund a revolution that has no money. And he's asking his little brother to give his inheritance for the cause. And his little brother is saying, wait a minute, I can't do this. I don't want to go in debt. And so it's an interesting interchange. It just shows you that family dynamics, even in the midst of this defining moment in our history, some family dynamics are truly universal.
Right. The Provincial Congress formed the Committee of Safety. Describe the role and Joseph Warren's role in this.
Yeah. Well, there was no governor in the provincial Massachusetts government at this time on the provincial side, on the Patriot side. And there was a Congress, but they needed an executive branch of some kind. And so it was the Committee of Safety that had those responsibilities, a relatively small committee that made those kinds of decisions as to, you know, when you're putting together an army, how many, what do we do, those kinds of things. And really, this was where Joseph Warren was the most prominent. And it was, he was, in essence, operating as the executive of the province. He dealt with a committee, but the frustrating thing for him was he was not only the head executive, but he was also head of the Congress. And it was, and a revolution was going on. And so this was a guy who was tugged in every possible direction, but he was so capable and charismatic that no one could conceive of anyone else but Joseph Warren in these offices.
Right. And of course, he was, as we mentioned, a doctor, a very good doctor, a very trusted. And he didn't. He wanted to fight. He wanted, to, you know, as you mentioned, he becomes a general. That's what he really wanted to
right.
do.
Right. And he knew from the beginning if this became a war, that he wanted to be on the field instead of. Instead of repairing injuries, he wanted to be fighting. And so he very carefully went about a program of preparing himself. Even before violence broke out, he was practicing with others, as militiamen do, in exercises. But when Lexington and Concord erupted, he made sure after sending out Paul Revere, after a quick meeting with the Committee of Safety, of going out and being there on the battle road. And according to several accounts, he was front and center. He was right up there. And in fact, he was apparently a very snappy dresser. And he had, and they all wore wigs, and they had the curls on their on their hair, and there was a pin that held the curls, and a musket, British musket ball, actually knocked the pin out. I mean, it's so close to killing him, but he was there. And then in subsequent skirmishes, he was there, and as Bunker Hill approached, he became a major general and would fight. Although he was so newly appointed, he felt he must fight as a volunteer and would ultimately die there.
Talk about Putnam.
Putnam, Israel Putnam. He was one of the more colorful characters.
He sure was.
he came from Connecticut, had been a kind of star in the French and Indian War, and, you know, one of these mythological figures where he had been captured by Indians and was about to be burned at the stake, and then a shower of rain put out the fire and he escaped, and, you know, these kinds of stories. And he was known to Bostonians. He had delivered some sheep to help them out when the Boston Port Act was first instituted. And he was one of the, and he was a big roly-poly guy who just liked to be in there and fight. He was impulsive and, you know, not necessarily a strategic thinker, but he was a favorite of everyone. But in the Battle of Bunker Hill, he was not necessarily the person we needed because
right. He did his own thing
and he could inspire others, but he did not see the big picture and have the ability to organize people in that way. And the Battle of Bunker Hill was a mess from the beginning. No one expected it to be a battle. By building a fort on what was supposed to be Bunker Hill, for reasons that are still unclear today, a fort was built instead on Breed's Hill, a half mile to the south, which put it right in the figurative face of the British. And instead of sort of being a defensive measure, was an act of defiance. And suddenly there was this battle that broke out. And Putnam may have had something to do with the fact that the fort was built on a wrong hill. We're not sure. But during this battle where, you know, all heck is breaking loose, Putnam is here, there, but having a hard time doing anything that was necessarily constructive, while William Prescott, who was in the redoubt, and John Stark from New Hampshire, who was at what was known as the rail fence and the stone wall, they were clearly doing things that were extraordinarily brave and effective in their own way, but both later had problems with Putnam.
Talk about the death of Joseph Warren.
Well, Joseph Warren came to the battle quite late. It was, you know, in the midst of it. By this time, Charlestown was burning. The British had ignited it. He came on the scene dressed to the T, and asked Putnam where would the fighting be the hottest. And also saying that he was fighting as a volunteer, not as a commanding officer. And so he was directed to the redoubt with William Prescott. And so he was there for three different British charges. Whether or not anyone said, hold your fire till you see the whites of their eyes, we'll never know for sure, but it's certainly a great myth. But he was there right until the end. And, I mean, it was just an awful battle where the British soldiers suffered casualties of 50%.
It's amazing, really.
Oh, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And it was hand-to-hand. And finally, the British just made their way up to this redoubt. And the colonial forces, provincials, had run out of gunpowder. And so the regulars came over the earthen walls of the redoubt with their swords in one hand and their muskets in the other. And Warren stayed there to the last possible moment. There's an account of him with a sword trying to rally people in the during the retreat, but he would be shot in the face with a pistol and die at the very last stages of the battle.
Hmm. We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Bunker Hill. One thing we didn't talk about is they learned that there's a spy among them. Here's another name that I don't think a lot of people are familiar with. And
yeah.
That's Benjamin Church.
Right. And I mean, what gave me a sense of deja vu is in Mayflower, my earlier book, the first Benjamin Church was an Indian fighter that you could argue helped turn the war around for the English. His great-grandson was a doctor and a foremost patriot. At least that's what everyone thought.
That's what they thought,
Dr. Benjamin Church. Turned out he was under pay as a British spy. And his letters have been preserved. And, you know, he was someone who wanted everything to go back to the way it was. Mm-hmm. And he was conflicted like many people, but he betrayed what would become another country. And it was after the Battle of Bunker Hill in that fall, he was found out. A letter that his girlfriend was trying to deliver to the British made its way into the American hands, and he was revealed as a spy, and it shook the foundations of everyone, because right. Here was Church, you know, who if he was a British spy, who could you believe?
Who could you trust anywhere?
Yeah.
And there were those who believed that there could be some kind of a compromise, and others who felt, nope, war is the only logical outcome.
Right, and you know, and this is the thing, and I, you know, how it ends up determines how the history is written. Mm-hmm. And of course, we all know what happened, independence. And so those that were push were the great, you know, the ones that saw where it was going. But those that wanted it to, you know, let's compromise, let's talk about it. And what I didn't realize is that, you know, how often that could have happened. And in fact, Joseph Warren, for example, even after Lexington and Concord, is writing secret letters to Thomas Gage in Boston saying, look, we can talk here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he is not betraying his side by any sense of any way. But he was one of these people who could see both sides. And people were deeply conflicted by this.
Now, let's talk about George Washington for a moment here. This is not the George Washington that we think about. He's young, and at this point, I guess he seems like he's trying to prove himself. So talk about George.
Well, you know, we all see George on the dollar bill, and, you know, he looks like this stoic icon that, you know, came into life as a statue. But it was great to see that, no, this was a flesh and blood guy, you know, who was trying to figure it out. And you know, he was a Virginian. And he suddenly finds himself amid thousands of Yankee soldiers, dirty, undisciplined, don't take orders. And it's maddening. And it just drives him crazy. And then he finds out he has no gunpowder. He has a British army under siege. And he wants to get this over with. And, you know, and the Continental Congress had said that as commander in chief, he needed to consult his council of war, about half a dozen generals. And Washington proposed to them in the fall of 1775, let's attack. Let's end this.
Yeah, and do it.
Let's do it. Yeah. And they said, wait a minute, you know, look at your soldiers. Look at the fact that we have almost no gunpowder. How are we going to do this? And several times Washington would make this proposal, and every time his council of war would say no. And, you don't know how much Washington is just trying to inject some life into it, and he clearly did that, and how much, it's a stand, but clearly he wanted to attack. And so the irony is that after Bunker Hill, the Brits decided, wait, this, we now know this is a war, but if we're going to continue this war, we're not going to fight it in New England. We're going to evacuate and begin it in New York. And so they were going to pull out anyways. Washington didn't know this. And so the biggest threat to Boston in the last year of the siege comes not from the British, who just want to get out of there, but from this young George Washington who wants to attack. Eventually, there would be the occupation of Dorchester Heights overlooking Boston with cannons provided by the Henry Knox, who's just one of the great characters, a bookseller who becomes, an officer.
There's a whole story there, too. Yeah.
And, but it's interesting to see Washington as kind of a firebrand.
Yeah. So as you're doing the research on this, which I know you find lots of surprises, but what were some of the biggest surprises that you learned as you were uncovering this story?
Well, I think the biggest, it was kind of a fundamental concept. We think of Boston as the center of defiance. Well, that was true in the beginning, and that leads to the Boston Tea Party. But once a British army arrives, a whole new dynamic occurs. And you see a city get turned inside out as the Patriots leave. And so this once original center of defiance becomes this British-occupied garrison. And this city is turned inside out, stuffed like as if by a taxidermist, with soldiers. And for me, that was the great surprise and became the central story of the book is, how do a people, how does a community, a city deal with this kind of truly revolutionary change?
Yeah. And other noteworthy characters. I mean, it's interesting to find these guys like the Benjamin Church and Joseph Warren. And there are others that, if you ask people, they would have no clue. And yet they were so key to this, the history here.
Oh, absolutely. There's an aspect of the story where Boston Harbor itself becomes kind of a battleground where the Continental guys go out in whaleboats, many of them stolen from my home port of Nantucket, and they're just driving the British warships crazy. And there's this guy, Benjamin Tupper, who leads about 40 whaleboats on not one but two attacks of the Boston Lighthouse, burns it down. And it drives these big captains of men of war crazy because they can't move around a harbor with all its mudflats and things as effectively. And so, yeah, there's a lot was going on. And and for me, this was a book of constant reassessment and discovery.
Well, it's funny because I remember reading Mayflower and, I can see where some of these, you got these questions, you went, where they could lead you to this book. So I'm wondering, as you were doing the research on this book, is that leading you to your next one?
Well, I'm not quite there yet. I'm taking a little bit of a deep breath, but I tell you, I think I have to go back to the Revolution. I need to see where Washington, what's going to happen to these guys. I feel so vested. And all my books are about America. And I've, and this obviously is kind of a formative period. And it just, we'll see.
Yeah. And Ben Affleck, Warner Brothers have optioned the book for a film. How do you feel about that?
I'm very excited. Yeah. I'm a fan of Ben Affleck's and of all his movies, and he knows Boston as well as anyone.
For sure. Yeah.
And we'll see.
Yeah. The book is Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution, Nathaniel Philbrick. Always good to see you. I love your books. Thanks for being here with us.
A great pleasure.
Coming up after the break, a fictional account of 19th century Nantucket astronomer Mariah Mitchell. Stay with us.